Then according to Xenocorps, all hands man your battle station.
This is the Man Battle Stations Podcast, the podcast of naval wargaming, all about ships on land, sea, air, and in space. Ahoy there, and welcome to episode 75 of the Man Battle Stations podcast. I'm Andy, also known as Rugdog on the forums, and for this episode, we have a very distinguished guest joining us today, Mr. Dale A. Jenkins, a former naval officer who has gone on to a long and successful career in business and finance. Mr. Jenkins has just written a book discussing the deteriorating relations between Japan and the United States that led to the start of the Pacific War. Welcome to the show, Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, Mr. Jenkins' press agent, Emily, reached out to me with a request for this interview and also provided me with a copy of the book, which this is terrible radio, but I am holding it up in front of me at the moment. And so I should specify, as always, that views expressed on the show are strictly mine and Mr. Jenkins alone. They do not reflect any official position of the U.S. government, DOD, or Navy, any other organization to which we're formally associated with. That little bit of legalese out of the way. Mr. Jenkins, having read your book, I'm very excited to discuss it with you. So on with the interview.
All right.
Now, before we get too deep into talking about the book, I was hoping to get to know you a little bit better. So if you wouldn't mind giving us sort of the Dale Jenkins origin story, what's your professional and academic background?
Well, I've spent most of my business career in finance, some real estate. But basically, I was a financial guy, and after I got too old for that, I was on the staff of the Council on Foreign Relations, which was a five-year, very interesting time. And after that, I followed my original instincts and got back into international diplomacy, which has always been a subject of great interest to me. My undergraduate degree is from Harvard. I majored in history, and I got an MBA from Columbia. In between the two, I was, because I was in ROTC in college, I served as an officer in the Navy, and spent most of that time, most of the 3 years on a destroyer in the Pacific.
Very interesting. Now, when you say you spent your time on a destroyer in the Pacific, were you deployed there? Were you, home ported out of Japan, or was it something that you just sort of made visits to?
Well, you're on destroyer and you move with the ship. We were in dry dock getting new sonar and radar in San Francisco. Then we moved down to Long Beach. Then from there, we're deployed to Yokosuka, Japan. So we went through Pearl Harbor, refueled at Midway, actually, and then went on to Yokosuka, Japan from there. And that meant travel, various missions, South Korea, all the way to Singapore, a lot in the Philippines, back and forth. And then something that we did then was Taiwan patrol.
Right.
The Taiwan Strait.
Sort of a classic Westpac experience, then.
Westpac experience, that's right.
What was the name of your ship? I'm just curious.
De Haven.
Oh, okay.
DDN 727, DD 727.
Nice. Was that Allen M. Sumner class, or?
Fletcher class.
Fletcher class, okay.
Yeah. All retired now.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, I've gotten a chance to tour the Case and Young up in Boston, so it's a very interesting museum. I'm sure something that you'd be very familiar with if you ever make a trip up there.
Right.
Now, you said you did a lot with diplomacy and diplomatic relations. Was there a particular area or region that you focused on in your diplomatic work, or was it sort of whatever happened to be coming through that needed to be done?
Well, I wouldn't say I've done diplomatic work. I've never had that experience in the government. There was some international business, but basically I've never been involved in diplomatic work. What interested me was a subject that became more and more significant. As we go along every year, we celebrate D-Day, June 6, 1944. And over the years, while I have great respect for the people that invaded there, great sympathy for the families that lost people there and for the rest of the war in Europe, the fact is, I've said to people, you're 2 years and 2 days late. The real turning point was at Midway in 1942, June 4th, 1942. This was the turning point in the Pacific, and it had heavy implications for the entire war.
And to be honest, just sort of peel back the curtain a little bit, that definitely comes across in your book. I noticed that you spend a substantial amount of time going into some significant detail with the Battle of Midway, not just with the actual fighting of the battle itself, but also with the lead-up, the planning, the work that it took to get those two carrier task forces in that same general vicinity of the ocean north of Midway on that morning. So that was something, like I said, that came across very clearly in your writing. So I guess we'll sort of use that as a little bit of a transition. Before we begin, is this your first book, or have you written others before?
This is my first book.
Oh, I got to say, it doesn't read like it. It's a very well-written and edited book. So, again, congratulations on that. So I guess, you know, sort of the elevator pitch here. What is your book called Diplomats and Admirals about?
Well, basically, it focuses on the 6 months prior to Pearl Harbor, the diplomatic relations that went on between Japan and the United States. That effort failed. We ended up with Pearl Harbor. So I described Pearl Harbor and then 6 months of naval operations after that, which were the carrier raids through the Pacific, the Doolittle raid on Tokyo, the Battle of the Coral Sea, and I finished with Midway.
Very interesting. So basically the sort of those pivotal first 6 months or so of the Pacific War that you zero in on there. Now, you talked a little bit about sort of your desire to keep the memory of the Battle of Midway alive in the public consciousness as kind of one of your inspirations. Were there other inspirations that led you to writing this book? What was sort of the events that called to you that led you to putting all this down on paper?
Well, I think the Navy really needs to have a story told more in more detail and in a more strategic way. We were in the war December 7th, 1941, when Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. For the next 8 or 9 months, it was entirely a Navy war. It was entirely a Navy war in the Atlantic, where our people were fighting U-boats.
Yes.
And in the Pacific, it was the carrier operations that I just described. We had no way of landing any troops anywhere until they landed on Guadalcanal in August of 1942. And even in that period of time, from August until, I think it was January of 43, the Marines fought hard battles against the Japanese, and they take great pride in their success. But what is almost overlooked is that offshore of Guadalcanal, there were 7 major naval battles. The Japanese were trying to supply their troops. We were trying to supply our troops. We were trying to interdict their supplies, and they were trying to do the same thing to us. 7 major battles. We sank 25 Japanese ships, including 2 battleships. They sank about 25 of our ships, including the Wasp and only slight different distance away, the Hornet. So these were hard-fought battles over a six-month period. And it was really 1943 until we could move into any sort of amphibious land combat.
Yeah, that's something that's always been. Yeah, if you look at you know, things like Neptune's Inferno, right? Yeah, you really get the sense of just how desperate and how closely fought those battles around Guadalcanal were. Excuse me. So, before we go into some of the more details about what's in the book, I am always curious when I have authors come on the show for interviews about what they sort of went through when writing the book. So, you know, what was your writing process? About how long did it take you to get the final version of the book ready for publication?
I would say seriously about 5 years. I've been thinking about it, read a bit over a period of, long period of time, but I would say 5 years of pretty concerted work. The COVID pandemic was in my favor because I was isolated.
Nothing to do but read and write, huh? So what kind of research did you undertake? I know you mentioned that you've done some reading and you do have a pretty extensive bibliography in the book, but was there any particular archival material that you dipped into for the research?
Well, once you get beyond what one reads in a bibliography or in what ends up in as a bibliography, I visited U.S. Archives in College Park, Maryland, to see original documents there. It's remarkable. One thing that I'll never forget was to having the Nimitz's after action report of Midway, dated June 15th, 1942. And these are the original documents with all the enclosures. There's about 10 enclosures of action reports of task force commanders, ship commanders, squadron commanders, all footnoted as enclosures on Nimitz's report. And I was there with, right in my hand, here's this top copy with the original signature, C.W. Nimitz, in blue ink, right there. It's
wow.
Very interesting to actually handle that page. There's a lot there, of course, in our national archives.
Oh, yes, I can only imagine. I've always wanted to make a visit there. I was a history major myself, so it's sort of like one of the dreams to go there and do some primary research.
I visited the Naval Academy Museum, and here again, there were original documents. Graduates of the Naval Academy wrote things back. One thing was handwritten. People that had participated, officers that had participated in Midway. I visited at Harvard, the Houghton Library of Rare Books, where Ambassador Grew deposited his papers. He was a Harvard graduate, and he gave those papers to Harvard. And here again, there's original documents with original signatures. And a lot of reports, his monthly reports, letters and so forth, and I don't think they've been widely circulated at all. Ambassador Grew is a tragic hero because he had a real understanding of what was going on in Japan. The advice he gave was spot on. I think we could have avoided Pearl Harbor had he been listened to, but unfortunately, the people in the State Department were oblivious. They favored China over Japan. They were not even handed about at all. And of course, we had Alger Hiss, the spy, mm-hmm. who was advising Hornbeck, who was one of the direct advisors to Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State. And anybody that favored Russia, of course, would say that, well, a war between Japan and the United States is a good thing because it would favor Russia. So we're still trying to sort out what part Alger Hiss might have played
right.
in those final negotiations in the end of November. I went to Monterey, the Naval War College Museum there, where they've scanned huge amounts of documents. It was all very helpful. And I interviewed with a former dive bomber pilot, George Walsh, who did not fly at Midway. He flew later in the war, Iwo Jima and Okinawa. But he introduced me to Dusty Kleiss, who was a dive bomber pilot at Midway, who was part of Gallagher's squadron, who dropped two bombs on Japanese carriers on June 4th.
I remember that name from your book. You definitely mentioned him.
I spoke with Dusty Kleiss on the phone twice. He was about 98 or 99 years old, wrote his own book, and died shortly after that.
Mm. Well, that's really interesting. Now, over the course of writing and researching your book, were there any major portions of the initial drafts that you ultimately had to modify or rewrite in a significant way based on something that you found over the course of your research?
Not really. I also researched as part of the naval war in the Pacific at that time, the action that was taking place around the Dutch East Indies. The Japanese, of course, had invaded down there. The Dutch had a significant navy. There was a big battle in the Java Sea. The British, the U.S., and the Dutch fought the Japanese there in several engagements. The Dutch had a great admiral named Doorman, great old sea dog who went down with one of his ships there. And I eventually decided not to include that. I decided to focus on the carrier war that was taking place in the Central Pacific.
I was going to say, you probably had to find some things to leave to the side. And that was going to be my next question, actually. You know, having done not necessarily books, but some essays, I know there's always a painful process where you have certain things that you really like, that you really wanted to talk about, but you ultimately have to leave on the cutting room floor in order to keep things to length. And so it sounds like your discussion on the Dutch East Indies and that sort of sub-theater of the war was one of the things you had to leave out, unfortunately.
It's a good subject there have been things written, and there's some work still to be done.
Yeah, I was going to say, Richard B. Frank's recent book, Tower of Skulls, discusses that campaign pretty well, I think. If you haven't had a chance to read that, I definitely recommend it. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to talking about some of the content that did make it into the book. Now, the summary on the dust jacket and some of the press materials Emily sent me highlight several points that you do tackle over the course of the book, and I wanted to highlight some of those here. And one of those is something that we just sort of mentioned by the side a few minutes ago, but could Pearl Harbor have been avoided? What historical outcome do you think could have been a likely alternative to ending up with a Japanese attack on December 7th?
Well, the background over the six-month period is that the Japanese invaded the southern portion of Indochina. Roosevelt decided that this was just too much, and he had to impose a qualified asset freeze on the Japanese, mainly involving the export of oil. The idea was to create a negotiation point and not cut it off completely, but just to allow some, cut it off, try to get the Japanese to negotiate and hopefully get them to withdraw from the southern part of Indochina or somehow alleviate the pressure that put on Singapore. Roosevelt went to meet Churchill in Newfoundland, and the Atlantic Conference occurred in August.
Yep.
And while he was gone, Assistant Secretary of State Dean Acheson imposed a total freeze on exports of oil, a total asset freeze, which cut off oil completely. And this threw Japan into a crisis because they imported essentially all of their oil and 90% of their oil from the United States. So they were in a position, they were either going to have to somehow get oil or they were going to fight for oil. And this is the negotiation that went on over several months. Finally, it got to a point after the Japanese had done more thorough analysis, and they had come to realize, or at least important aspects of the government, including the then prime minister, realized that they could not defeat the United States in a war. So there they were going to either be strangled by this complete cutoff of oil, or they were going to fight the United States and lose. In the November the 20th, they presented a proposal that they would withdraw from the southern end of Indochina. And we had, at about the same time, had a similar proposal that amounted essentially to the same thing. And this was a deal ready to be done. At the last minute, Chiang and Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, circulated the draft agreement of our proposal around the Dutch, the British, and the Chinese. Chiang Kai-shek came back and said, you cannot possibly have an agreement with China. And I want to read something out of the book where he said, if there's any reduction of the embargo or freezing regulations or relief of that gains ground, then the Chinese people would consider that China has been completely sacrificed by the United States. The morale of the entire people will collapse and every Asiatic nation will lose faith. The Chinese army will collapse. And such a loss would not be to China alone, which is sort of a veiled threat against us. But this is in the book.
Yes.
At that point, Cordell Hull was in a quandary. He didn't know what to do. He didn't feel like he could act in violation of this so-called a working agreement with China, even though China's motives and positions were very different from the United States. The United States was not bound by this protest from China. So he gave the Japanese a much more demanding note, which required that they withdraw from all of Indochina, all of China, and possibly even all of Manchuria. This was considered by Japan to be an ultimatum. This was November the 26th, 1941. The Japanese looked at that and said, no, we cannot possibly succumb to this. If nothing else, pride forces us to fight.
Hence the climb Mount Itaka message.
2 weeks later, Pearl Harbor.
Yep. That was one thing that really came across in your account of these events was just how much the United States diplomatic efforts were hinging on trying to do this as a multilateral approach where you tried to include Great Britain and the Dutch and China as opposed to a willingness to more or less deal directly bilaterally with just the Japanese, and that might have actually hindered the efforts to prevent war from breaking out.
That's right.
Very interesting. Well, so moving on then into the outcome of the battle, or I should say the implications and results of the attack on Pearl Harbor, do you think that the outcome of World War II, if the U.S. had not been attacked at Pearl Harbor, would have been different? In other words, do you think that the U.S. would have been able to stay out of the war if they hadn't been directly attacked in December?
Well, I mean, this is such a difficult question. While all this was going on in 1941, the military and, of course, everybody else realized that the major threat was Hitler in Europe. Japan had limited capabilities. Nazi Germany was far more formidable. And the military, our military, had been saying to Roosevelt, whatever you do, don't get involved in a war with Japan because the major threat is Hitler. Now, had we not been attacked at Pearl Harbor, it's possible that the carriers could have been withdrawn. There were huge amphibious invasions that were planned, which in fact took place as part and parcel of the Pearl Harbor attack. Pearl Harbor was in fact the flanking protection. A big attack was going down through Malaya, Borneo, the Philippines, Guam. They even attacked Wake Island within a few hours of Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was a massive amphibious operation. Now, would that have been withdrawn? Maybe, maybe not. It's very hard to know about that. But even if it hadn't been, these were European countries trying to protect their colonies in the Pacific. It was a far less demanding situation for us. But yet, Roosevelt had said, we cannot afford to have further expansion by Japan. And he also said he would consider an attack by Japan to be an attack against all of the Axis powers. Now, that that decision didn't have to be made. Hitler made it for him 4 days after Pearl Harbor.
Yes, it's another one of those great head scratchers of history. So why you would want to do that, right? So,
so could we have stayed out of the war if Japan had not attacked it as Pearl Harbor? I think it would have been difficult.
I mean, we were already trading torpedoes with the Germans in the Atlantic even before Pearl Harbor, so things were already starting to deteriorate there.
And Roosevelt thought all along we would eventually get drawn into the European war because the European countries could not stand up against Hitler themselves.
Well, very interesting. Now, one of the things that you have spent a lot of time talking about, of course, as we talked earlier, is Midway. And you have some interesting sort of new discussion points about the battle. A lot of the things that led up to the battle are already pretty well known, as far as the efforts of Station Hypo and the efforts to decipher Japanese codes, the effort to get Yorktown repaired and back underway in time. But there were some other insights you gained into the planning for the battle that I really wanted to get your discussion and thoughts on, because I found it very interesting.
Okay. Well, we had the Japanese code broken. We knew they were coming. The Yorktown, you know, when steaming back from Coral Sea, damaged. They put the Yorktown together in 3 days. We had it ready to go out again. We knew they were coming. We had three carriers, Enterprise, Hornet, and Yorktown. We had planes on the island of Midway. The decryption of the Japanese advance was so well known that Lieutenant Commander Layton, Nimitz's intelligence officer, plotted it out. On June 4th, they were going to be on course 135, which is a southeast course. They're going to launch about half their planes against Midway itself to destroy the defenses there in anticipation of an amphibious invasion. They had the amphibious fleet operating independently of the carriers. So that the plan was that we would fly our scouting planes, PBYs, and they would, the Japanese would launch their planes at 0430. At the same time, we would be launching our planes at the same time. And the idea, the 22 planes would fan out, and they would find, the plan was that they would find the Japanese, intercept them about 175 miles from Midway, because the Japanese would maintain their southeast course. They would launch from 240 because that was the range of the Japanese planes. They would move in as close as 175, and then the planes from Midway would take off when the report came that the Japanese fleet had been discovered, and they would meet the Japanese when the carriers had advanced a little bit further, about 140 miles from Midway. So that was the plan for the Japanese planes. That was the plan for the Midway planes. And they had confirmation of that because the day before, the same scouting planes had moved out. They had found the amphibious fleet. so that they knew from that that the Japanese plan was on track. The question was, where would the carriers be in order to have a concentration of force? It's a basic military concept. You concentrate your force. You just don't go off in a wave. This has been the case since Hannibal concentrated elephants against the Roman lines. Every military commander wants to have a concentration of force. In the Navy, it's the crossing the T, so that you can concentrate your broadsides against the first one or two of an enemy battle line. So what was going to be the concentration of force? What did we know from the action report that Fletcher submitted as part of the Nimitz battle plan? He was to be 200 miles north of Midway. Historians that interviewed people, participants in the battle at the time, Samuel Eliot Morrison, E.V. Potter, that wrote the biography of Nimitz, Richard Bates, who was at the Naval War College at the time, all three of them independently, from their analysis and from their interviews, said that our carriers were to be 200 miles north of Midway at 0600 on the 4th of June. Now, when you plot that out, what do you find? You find out that position is 140 miles from Midway, from the intersection point. And I plotted this out. You can see it in my book.
Yes.
If it comes up. This was like the concentration of force was achieved by the planes from Midway flying 140 miles back up the Japanese course. And the carriers, 200 miles north of Midway, were also 140 miles from the interception point, which meant that if the carriers took off, you know, roughly flying the same speeds with different planes, that would have to be adjusted.
Right.
In fact, they had 140 miles to fly. The planes from Midway had 140 miles to fly. They could meet in a concentration of force over the Japanese carriers that would be defended by only half the planes because the others were still on their mission attacking Midway. That was the battle plan.
Very intricate timing to try and get all the aircraft over the Japanese force at roughly the same time.
That was the plan. The problem was the carriers, for unknown reasons, were 60 or 70 miles away from the point 200 miles north of Midway, which meant that they were 200 miles from the interception point, and they were out of range. So they had to close the range to get to 175 miles before they could launch any planes. Well, 25 miles with carriers traveling at 25 knots means that it takes an hour to close the range. Spruance by that time was detached from the rest of the force, and he had to plot courses for the planes to fly on to attempt a new interception of the Japanese carriers. At that point, we had no backup scouting planes. They'd all been used on the earlier in the morning. And they didn't think Nimitz didn't think he'd need any more scouting because that was the plan.
All right.
The force. So Spruance was left with having to use a dead reckoning plot, assuming that the Japanese carriers would maintain course and speed. And he did that and plotted a course of about 240 for the planes from the Hornet and Enterprise to fly on and to attempt a new interception of the Japanese carriers, which they proceeded to do. They flew. The air group commander of Hornet was independent of the Enterprise. Spruance wanted independent judgment on the two air group commanders. it turns out that they flew to the point where they could expect to intercept the Japanese carriers. By this time, it's about 9:25. And there was no Japanese carriers. Why were there no Japanese carriers? Because they had been delayed by earlier action, and by that time, their scouts had found the U.S. carriers, and the Japanese admiral turned northeast to close to the with the American carriers. So here were our two air groups looking over empty ocean. We had two air groups on a southwest course. Neither one could find the Japanese carriers, which is pretty obvious by that time because the delays and the Japanese carriers had changed course. So the Hornet Air Group turned southeast, thinking that perhaps the Japanese were between him and the island of Midway. And he went in that direction. The Enterprise Air Group commander, a guy named McCluskey, lieutenant commander, he was in command of two squadrons. He had 32 dive bombers. He assumed that the best way to find the Japanese was to go back up the course that they had been on and just retrace their movement, which he proceeded to do. He flew for about 20 minutes on that course, finally decided, no, they're not here. So where could they be? He didn't think they could be south, because he had been flying a little bit south of the course anyway, and he thought, maybe by this time they found our carriers, which were the northeast. So he turned to the northeast. All 32 planes follow him. They start a search pattern, and just then he saw a Japanese destroyer heading northeast. So he said, I'll follow them. He follows them, and all of a sudden, coming out from a cloud layer, there's the Japanese carrier fleet. So two squadrons of dive bombers, each one took a Japanese carrier, and they destroyed two carriers. At the same time, the Yorktown planes had found another carrier, and they destroyed that. But there was still a fourth carrier. The torpedo planes from Yorktown attacked that carrier's name was Hiryu, the Japanese junior admiral aboard. The Zero fighters shot down all the torpedo planes. And so after that, the Hiryu launched attacks against what turned out to be Yorktown in two waves. And that led to the Yorktown being sunk. The Enterprise planes, meanwhile, this is, a few hours went by here. They got back to Enterprise, rearmed, refueled, and launched another attack and sank Hiryu. So four Japanese carriers sunk.
And basically crushing the ability for Japan to conduct operational and strategic offensives at that point. So
that really killed their offense.
Yeah.
No question about it. They had plenty of fight left in them, but there was no way they were going to win this Pacific War at that point.
Yeah, as Jonathan Parshall, the author or co-author of Shattered Sword, put it, it amounted to a national catastrophe for Japan. Well, I think that is sort of it for the major discussion points I had, and we are sort of getting close to the end of our time here. But I did want to give you an opportunity to go ahead and bring up any other points or any other significant items from your book that you wanted to discuss. So, Dale, over to you.
I think we've covered the point pretty well. I want to go back to really one of my early motivations, and that is the recognition for the Navy. I hope it means just recognition and not a lack of appreciation, because that really would not be accurate at all. But right now, we're in a position with China that they're rebuilding their Navy, and they're doing a lot. And looks like if we're going to have a hot point, flash point anywhere in the world, it's going to be Taiwan. We're going to be potentially involved in the Yellow Sea, the Taiwan Strait, the East China Sea, the South China Sea, and the Indian Ocean. We have to be prepared for that. And at the, right now, in the news, like yesterday, there's a new selection to be made for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Two officers, one from the Air Force, one from the Army, are being considered for that. The Navy is not being considered. Why? Because they already have the Vice Chief of Naval Operation, an Admiral Christopher Grady. So my, what I think should be considered here is that Admiral Grady should be moved up to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and let somebody else become the vice chairman. I'll close that with an idea. Let's appreciate the need that's there. There have been 20 chairmen of the Joint Chiefs since that office was established in the late 40s. 20. Four of them have been Navy admirals. Only four out of 20. In my view, it probably should have been twice that many. But here we are, where we are right now, and I think that the Navy admiral is what we need to be the next chairman, because we're likely to be fighting in the Western Pacific, and we better be prepared.
All right. Well, no argument from me on that. Now, one last question, and this one just is sort of a fun one. You do touch on wargaming in the very beginning of your book, talking about some of the effort that was being done by both the Americans and the Japanese to sort of figure out how a war in the Pacific might be fought and what the best way to go about it might be. Do you personally have any experience in wargaming, either as a hobby or as something that you've done professionally?
No. Unless you want to call some business transactions wargaming. I've never been in a war gaming. There was a board game on Midway about 30 years ago.
Yep.
And I played that with a guy I knew. It was you know, nothing electronic at all. It was a piece of board, like a checkers game.
Well, that definitely counts. So it's funny you mentioned that old Avalon Hill Midway game. We just did an interview here on the show with a fellow down in Texas that ran that show as, or that game as a convention event. And he had two teams, one playing the American forces, one playing the Japanese forces. And he did it up with a bunch of cardboard dividers so they would be double blind. He was, doing a very, very good job of giving those players something of the experience of what it might have been like to be, Spruance or Nagumo trying to outguess the other and actually figure out where their opponent was and get that critical first strike in. So,
right.
Yeah, no, that definitely counts. That definitely counts. As we are nominally a naval wargaming podcast, I always like to ask that question when we have somebody on for an interview.
There are very sophisticated games out there now.
Oh, yes. Well, I think that will about do it for our interview. Now, before we let you go, Dale, I always like to give our guests the opportunity to let folks know how they can find out what they're up to. So, as far as social media goes, do you have any place where people can go and reach out if they're interested in your book or want to find out more about your effort?
Well, my website is www.daleajenkins.com. And we lay out as much as we sensibly can on that. I do some things with social media, not a lot. Basically, it's the website and talking to people like you. And people in the Navy have been kind enough to invite me to places where I've been able to talk with some of the veterans. Not of the Pacific War, but of current veterans. And I want to do more talking with think tanks and some people that are involved with current strategy on the diplomatic side as well as the military.
Well, very, very interesting. Again, thank you for coming on the show. This has been a great discussion. Again, the book is Diplomats and Admirals, and I do recommend you pick it up. It is a good read. It is a relatively quick read at 300 pages, and it does touch upon a very important period for both U.S. and Japanese history, and really world history in general, if you think about the wider implications of what transpired there during that time period.
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, we will include links to that as well as your website, Dale, in the show notes for those of you out there that are interested in checking those out. Okay, so real quick here before we wrap up, next episode here on the show is going to be a review of the solitaire board game Spruance Leader, a little bit of Cold War naval action. So you can look forward to that. I'm going to have our friend Rob back on to discuss that one. As for this episode, if you have any feedback or have questions for us, email us at podcast@manbattlestations.com, or you can post in the episode thread in the Man Battle Stations forum. And if you enjoyed this episode, you can help us out by spreading the word. Sharing on social media and or leaving positive reviews on iTunes is always greatly appreciated. And with that, it is time to bring episode 75 of the Man Battle Stations podcast to a close. Until next time, this is Ruck Dog saying good luck and good hunting.